FT 90.1 FM
ओहाई पैसिफिक अथॉरिटी किसिंग से।
चलिए आज हम सब मिल करके इस धरती पे शांति के लिए प्रार्थना करें।
तुम तो मुन्ना है लेंस था तो ये लेंगे दाव दिस बीच तुम तो ला पैसिफिका रेडियो KPFT 90.1 FM
一道向和平进发，我哋系侯司长嘅 Pacifica KPFT 90.1 FM 90.1。
Mimi ni Pacifica, uhuru wa mazungumzo kwa watu walio huru.
हम ताकत के सामने भी सच्चाई से बोलते हैं। हम है Pacifica Radio KPFT 90.1 FM.
Let's all get together and pray for the peace on earth.
من غير العدالة مش ممكن نواجه السلام.
Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free, KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, producer and host of Arab Voices, along with my co-host Mark. This week marks the fifth anniversary of Arab Voices, broadcasting live every Wednesday. I started this show on April 16, 2002, and since then we have covered a wide range of topics, including the occupation of Iraq and Palestine extensively. We've talked about Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, Sudan, Somalia, the U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East, the U.S. Patriot Act, civil liberties, abuses and violations of the rights of immigrants, including Arabs and Muslims in the U.S., hate crimes, Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, just to name a few. Over the past 5 years, we hosted live over 200 distinguished guests and politicians from around the globe, such as Senator James Abu Rizq, the first Arab American to serve in the U.S. Senate and founder of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, Congressman Paul Findlay, author of the bestseller book They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby, Mordechai Vanunu, Israeli nuclear whistleblower, who was indicted by the State of Israel for appearing on this show on Arab Voices, Dr. Azmi Bshara, intellectual writer and member of the Israeli Knesset, Marcel Khalifa, Lebanese composer and oud master, Tariq Ali, a long-time anti-war activist, Dr. Clofis Maqsoud, former ambassador of the Arab League to the United Nations, Dr. Victor Batarsa, mayor of the city of Bethlehem, where Jesus was born, Captain James Yusuf Yi, former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain at Camp Delta in Guantanamo Bay, Ralph Nader, presidential candidate, Scott Ritter, former chief U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq, Dr. Asad Abu Khalil, Arab-American scholar and professor of political science, Dahir Jamal, independent Western reporter in occupied Iraq, talking to Arab Voices live from Iraq, Dr. Ahmad Khadouri, Iraqi nuclear scientist who used to work with the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission, Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst for 27 years, Flint Leverett, Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the U.S. National Security Council and Senior Middle East Analyst at the CIA, Ali Abu Ni'ma, co-founder of Electronic Intifada and Electronic Iraq, Naum Chomsky, political activist and writer, and many, many more. As a matter of fact, the entire list of all guests and topics covered on this show over the past 5 years is listed on our website at www.arabvoices.net. And on this fifth anniversary, I want to take this opportunity to thank KPFT, our commercial-free community radio station, for allowing us to be on the air and providing this opportunity to bring to the greater Houston area such a show. And I would also like to congratulate you, the listeners, for supporting this show and KPFT. It is because of you, the listener sponsors of KPFT and Arab Voices, that we are able to bring you this show. Thank you very much. Shukran jazilan. And we are hoping to bring you this show for many, many more years to come. Today, we have another distinguished guest live on the show, and that will be Dr. Mohammad Rabia, professor of international political economy, who taught at several Arab and American universities, publisher of numerous books, including The Politics of Foreign Aid, A Vision for the Transformation of the Middle East, The Middle East Peace Process, the USPLO Dialogue, who also drafted the original document that guided negotiations and coordinated secret contacts between the U.S. and the PLO. We will talk with Dr. Rabia about the politics of foreign aid, the U.S. foreign assistance and aid to Israel, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the peace process and what it takes to revive it, the U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East, and much more. We will also take your calls live, so please make a note of the phone number. It is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. But first, let's start with Arab Voices Community Calendar.
Guantanamo, a word and a place that have become part of our vocabulary, unsettling and unseen, invoking some of the most controversial aspects of the war on terror since 2001. Guantanamo, Pictures from Home, Questions of Justice, is an exhibition that gives us a rare glimpse into the life of the prison, the men who are detainees, and the U.S. lawyers who represent them, with images, stories, and videos. The words of the lawyers who are representing the detainees, their photographs and interviews, the declassified proceedings from military tribunals, will take you from the Middle East and Afghanistan into the cells of Guantanamo. The stories raise deeply troubling questions of how the U.S. is dealing with the war on terror and its reverberations throughout the world. The exhibition, Guantanamo, Pictures from Home, Questions of Justice, will be on public view at Photo Fest from March 31st through May 19th. For more information, please contact Vinod at 713-459-7294 or visit www.photofest.org.
Palestinians for Peace and Democracy and the bilateral U.S.-Arab Chamber of Commerce are co-sponsoring a special gala titled Peace Through Development, where Dr. Hanan Ashrawi, Palestinian scholar, author, politician, activist, and member of the Palestinian Legislative Assembly, will be the guest speaker. This gala will include Palestinian cultural exhibition, auction of handmade Palestinian dresses representing the unique traditions of 12 Palestinian cities, towns, and villages. The funds raised will benefit economic development for the women of Palestine by establishing the West Bank's first woman-owned and operated canning factory. This event will be held this coming Friday, April 20, at 7 p.m. at the Sheraton Suites Hotel, located on 2400 West Loop South near the Galleria. For more information, contact Sahar at 281-565-6161.
America at the Crossroads, a major public television event that explores the challenges confronting the post-9/11 world, including the war on terrorism, the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, the experience of American troops serving abroad, the struggle for balance within the Muslim world, and global perspectives on America's role overseas, has started premiering on Houston's PBS Channel 8 this week. Each night, the host, Robert McNeil, provides context to the compelling stories and provocative points of view to be shown throughout that week. The series of 11 independently produced documentaries is running nightly through Friday, April 20th. Additional films will air as specials following the premiere. For more information and to check the schedule, visit www.pbs.org/WETA, that's W-E-T-A, /crossroads.
The Egyptian ambassador to the United States, Nabil Fahmy, will be in Houston next week talking about Egypt's role in the Middle East. This event, sponsored by the Houston World Affairs Council, will be held on Tuesday, April 24 at 11:30 a.m. at the Western Galleria Hotel, located on 5060 West Alabama. For more information, visit www.hwac.net.
The Rothko Chapel is hosting a special. It's titled World of Walls. It's a series exploring the cultural, political, and human rights ramifications of barriers, both visible and invisible. One of those lecture series will feature Dr. Osama Maqdisi. He's the Associate Professor of History at Rice University, a recognized authority on the Middle East, and a guest on this show several times. He will talk about the problems of the Israeli-Palestinian wall. Dr. Maqdisi holds the Arab-American Educational Foundational Chair of Arab Studies, and he will also discuss other people barriers in the Middle East. The event will be held May 16th, 7:30 p.m. at the Rothko Chapel. That's at 1409 Sol Ross. For more information, visit www.rothkochapel.org.
The Arab American Cultural and Community Center in Houston will hold a family picnic on Sunday, April 29, from 12 noon to 8 p.m., at the ACC, located on 10555 Stancliff Road. This will be a great day of fun for the entire family, with live music by California singer Nidal Jaludi. There will also be food, soft drinks, music, soccer, volleyball, basketball, games for the children, and much more. For more information, call the ACC at 832-351-3366.
And finally, for the calendar of events, mark your calendars, May 11th and 13th and 18th through the 20th, two weekends in May. They're going to be the Houston Palestine Film Festival. We don't have the full schedule yet, but we'll be posting those information on the website and announcing it here as soon as we can. So stay tuned for that.
Hello, may I help you?
Hello, can I ask a few questions about the apartment you have on Park Street?
What was your name?
My name is Juan Hernandez.
It's been rented.
Oh, it's gone?
Hello?
Hello, my name is Sanjay Kumar. I am calling about the apartment on Park Street.
It's not available.
It's not available, but I just now saw it in the paper.
May I help you?
My name is Tyrone Washington. I'm calling about the place to rent on Park Street.
No longer available.
Oh, it's not available now.
Nope, sorry.
Okay.
Hello?
Yes, hello. My name is Graham Wellington. I'm calling about the apartment for rent on Park Street. Is that still available?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Oh, really? I'd love to make an appointment.
Housing discrimination is illegal. If you think you've been a victim because of your race, color, national origin, sex, religion, disability, or family status, call 800-669-9777 or visit fairhousinglaw.org. Fair housing. It's not an option. It's the law. Brought to you by HUD, the Ad Council, and LCCREF.
And for more detailed information about the events we just mentioned, or for a list of many other activities scheduled in Houston, please visit our website at www.arabvoices.net. You will also find links to alternative news and resources about the Arab world, its culture and civilization, as well as resources for Arab Americans and about Arab Americans. That's www.arabvoices.net. We will take a break now, and when we come back, we will talk with Dr. Muhammad Rabia, professor of international political economy, who taught at several Arab and American universities, publisher of numerous books, including The Politics of Foreign Aid, A Vision for the Transformation of the Middle East Peace Process, and the USPLO Dialogue, who also drafted the original document that guided negotiations and coordinated secret contacts between the U.S. and the Palestine Liberation Organization. We will talk with Dr. Rabia about the politics of foreign aid, the U.S. foreign assistance and aid to Israel, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the peace process and what it takes to revive it, the U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East, and much more. We will also take your calls live, so please make a note of the phone number. It is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. And by the way, the song we are about to hear now is written by Dr. Muhammad Rabia. We will talk about it after we listen to it. Welcome back to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, producer and host of Arab Voices, along with my co-host, Mark. Joining us now live in the studio is Dr. Muhammad Rabia. Dr. Rabia is a professor of international political economy. He studied in Egypt, Germany, and the United States and holds a PhD degree in economics from the University of Houston. He taught at several Arab and American universities, including Kuwait University, Georgetown University, the Johns Hopkins University, and Al-Akhawain University in Morocco. He was a guest professor at the MCM Institute of St. Gallen University in Switzerland and also served as an academic advisor to Erfurt University in Germany and was its U.S. representative. Professor Rabia has published extensively in English and Arabic. His English books include The Politics of Foreign Aid, A Vision for the Transformation of the Middle East, The New World Order, Conflict Resolution and the Middle East Peace Process, Conflict Resolution and Ethnicity, The Making of History, and the US-PLO Dialogue. In addition, Dr. Rabia has published a short story, A Journey with Warriors, and two books of poetry, The Train of Time and Autumn of Memories, and more than 50 scholarly papers and over 500 newspaper articles. He has two other books under publication and a novel in Arabic. Dr. Rabia had previously served as a board member of the Arab Fund for Technical Assistance for African and Arab Countries and the Steering Committee of the Euro-Arab Dialogue. Currently, Dr. Rabia is a member of the Authors Guild, the Authors League of America, the Alexander von Humboldt Stiftung, the Arab Thought Forum, and the Advisory Board of the UNESCO sponsored book in a newspaper project, and a few other professional and academic associations. He also served as a member of both the Harvard University and the Brookings Institution's working groups to advance peace and economic development in the Middle East. He was also a board member of the Search for Common Ground Middle East Initiative. Dr. Rabia is the recipient of several grants and awards as student and professor from American, Egyptian, German, Jordanian, Kuwaiti, and UN agencies and foundations. Dr. Muhammad Rabia conceived the idea of the US-PLO dialogue, drafted the original document that guided negotiations, and coordinated secret contacts between the U.S. and the Palestine Liberation Organization that led the U.S. to recognize the PLO and open a dialogue with it. Dr. Rabia, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you, and we are very pleased to have you with us. I wanted to ask you first about the song we heard, which is called Nurmina. My understanding, it is your words. You authored that song for somebody to sing. Tell us about that.
Sometimes people think that you have to have an experience to write. But I believe you could have an experience, and also you could write from your own memories. And one day I was sitting at the balcony of a friend of mine in Beirut, overlooking the Mediterranean Sea, and it was sunset time. Then I remembered a lighthouse that I saw it in a small island in Cancun. And I was able to just put the two pictures together, like one on the top of the other. And I coined the word Nur Mina from Nur in Arabic, which means light, and Mina, which means the port, Mina. And just put it together and makes just like saying the light of the port. And I wrote that song that represents, in my view, how the Arabs are one nation and how each country has something to offer to the larger Arab community.
And I think that was a very a wonderful song, and especially when you mentioned some of the Arab countries that are talked about in the song and so on. So really congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Dr. Rabia, I wanted to first ask you also about the tragedy in Iraq today. It is really no different than any other day. Maybe today the number is a little bit higher. And unfortunately, you know, we bring this up and people think these are just numbers, but these are human beings. I mean, the tragedy is a catastrophe, even if one person is killed. Today, at least 182 people were killed, nearly 250 were wounded in several bombings across Baghdad. Baghdad was rocked with bombs, and the situation has been like this since the U.S. invaded and occupied Iraq. What is your take on this whole U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq and what's happening there?
As most people have already recognized, this invasion was not justified and the occupation is illegal. And the U.S. probably officially has not accepted responsibility for invading Iraq and causing this tragedy. But as long as the occupation forces are in Iraq and as long as there is no conciliation in Iraq, I think the bloodshed will continue. And I do not think myself that the a new security plan will work as planned. It might cause some reduction in the level of violence, but I think without... I wrote an article in Arabic and I timed it at the time to be published. I have a weekly article that I write and it's published in two newspapers in Arabic, in Al-Dastur in Jordan and Al-Bayan in Dubai. And I timed that article to be published when President Bush visited Jordan to meet with the Prime Minister of Iraq. And in that one, I proposed some kind of way out of this conflict in Iraq. That doesn't mean that I had a solution, but I think I had a plan that has a good chance of working. And some of the things that I said in that one is that they have to recall the old army that was organized at the time of Saddam Hussein, as well as the police force and the security forces, because that was the only army that was trained to protect Iraq as Iraq. It was the only nationalist army. The army that we have today is a sectarian army to a great extent, and this is why a good number of those people are party to the crimes that are being committed in Iraq today. And also I said that we have to have a conference, which I called it Musalaha wa Musamaha, which means reconciliation and forgiveness, because reconciliation by itself doesn't work, and you have to have forgiveness. Because if we continue to say, all right, that the Shiites have to take revenge and the Sunnis have to take revenge, the bloodshed will continue and there will no end to it. So we have to accept the principle of reconciliation and also forgiveness, that the mutual forgiveness, then the people will be able to start anew. In addition to that, we will have to have a good economic development plan to start working in Iraq. So the, my plan had 7 points. These, I would say, the major 4 points in that plan.
Do you subscribe to the thought that says if the U.S. withdraws its forces now from Iraq, it will even get into more chaos, as if what we see now is not enough chaos?
I really don't know. I don't think anyone really knows. But I think that the government in Iraq today is not functioning. I don't think it can deal with the issues of the conflict. I don't think that the Prime Minister of Iraq is doing enough to bring the other parties, the Iraqi people, to the table and work with them. And also there's no doubt that the Saddam Hussein regime had committed untold crimes in Iraq, but the situation in Iraq was much better than what it's today, or at least wasn't as bad as it is today. We should not really use the word better, but it wasn't as bad and as bloody and as hopeless as it is today.
And over the past years since the U.S. started invading Iraq, some reports put the estimate of the deaths on the Iraqi side, on the civilian side, to well over 1 million now. Some say 750,000. We've seen reports at over 1 million, and the tragedy continues. And the human cost is humongous in Iraq.
I mean, for Americans to understand the magnitude of the killing in Iraq, they have to think that 1 million is almost 5% of the Iraqi people. And if you compare it to the American population today, you're talking about 15 million.
Wow.
So can you imagine that 15 million Americans get killed? And also at the same time, there are more than 1 million kids or children in Iraq who have become without parents. So can you imagine that 15 million getting killed and 15 million children now are living on the streets without parents?
It is horrific. It is truly horrific and indescribable what's going on in Iraq. I wanted to ask you also about another story that has made headlines today. The Arab League, basically they've asked or they've assigned Egypt and Jordan to kind of revive the Arab initiative, or to talk directly with Israel, or try to convince Israel to accept or to work with the Arab Initiative that was made public a few years ago in 2002, I believe, in Lebanon.
Yes.
And so they can move forward with the peace process. We know all along that Israel has said no to this initiative and so on. Do you see that this will be fruitful or it will make any difference?
I don't think anyone can say for sure what is going to happen or what might happen. But there is no doubt that the Arab plan that was offered to Israel and continue to be offered is a good plan for both the Israelis and for the Arabs and for the Palestinians in particular. So peace could be achieved and a Palestinian state could be established in the West Bank and Gaza. But when I am a frequent visitor to Germany, I go there once, twice, sometimes three times a year on lecture tours. I was there in February and I'll be back in June and again in August. And when people ask me when peace will be established, I say simply when Israel accepts any of the plans that were offered to it. Israel was offered 242, it was offered 338, it was offered the Geneva, it was offered the Arab peace plan, it was offered the roadmap, and there are some other initiatives offered by other people, just like the plan that I offered myself back in 1989, which I called it a vision for the transformation of the Middle East, and Israel has not accepted any of them. You know, people say, okay, Israel accepted, let's say, the roadmap. But the Israelis put 17 conditions on accepting the roadmap. So when you have a plan and you have to do 17 modifications to it, then nothing is left of it. So when the Israelis try and make up their mind and say, yes, we are going to accept this plan, I think we'll be on a road that will lead to peace. But without that, I don't think there will be a road and there is no peace.
What is the U.S. role in all of this? Regardless of the propaganda and all the stuff we read there, the peace process, and the U.S. is proctor, and the U.S. is the promoter of the peace process and wants people to have peace there, they have a big say in what makes the Israeli policy and how they shape it, or they can pressure Israel, at least because of the funding that the United States provides to Israel, these billions of dollars every single year. So the U.S. can exercise power, can exercise pressure on the state of Israel, yet the United States has stood alone all along. They talk about peace, but they never really pressure Israel, nor do they ask Israel to abide by the United Nations resolutions, at least where Israel stands in violation of at least 65 or 72 U.N. Security Council resolutions and so on. Is the U.S. really a fair peace broker here?
No. No, the U.S. has never been. In fact, since President Johnson, because President Johnson, when the 242 was introduced in the U.N., he insisted, or the United States representative at the time insisted, that that resolution would not include calling for Israeli withdrawal to the lines that were established before the war started. And left it open, and they said withdrawal from land occupied recently. And this is why when the Israelis say, and the Arabs, they have always a legal disagreement over the 242 resolution. When the Arabs say it includes withdrawal till to the 1967 borders, the Israelis say no, it did not use the article the. It says from a land occupied in recent war. So the United States has not stood for peace, except I would say President Carter shortly, and he succeeded in making peace between Egypt and Israel, and President Clinton tried, but unfortunately he tried too late and he was too slow, and he accepted the slow pace of the Israeli Prime Minister at that time, Ehud Barak, and this is why he ran out of time and was not able to achieve anything. Let me say something about President Bush. The story says when President Bush had his first meeting, or his first meeting for his cabinet, he told them, we are not going to be the Clintons. So we are not going to do anything that the Clinton administration had tried. And then later on, Colin Powell, he came and reminded President Bush, say that, you know, if we don't do anything in the Middle East, things are going to get worse. He said, well, let them get worse, because things cannot get better unless they get worse. So this is the kind of attitude that, unfortunately, President Bush had adopted from the beginning, and he continued to adopt the same policy and the same attitude.
And we're seeing the consequences and the results. It's still going on. Living under military occupation is... Military occupation to me by itself is one of the highest forms of terrorism, subjecting millions of people to daily atrocities and so on. What about the U.S. aid to Israel? The U.S. gives Israel billions of dollars, cash money, military assistance, all kinds of military equipment, despite Israel's use of this equipment in total violation of our own, of the United States' own Arms Export Act. What can you share with us about this and about this financial aid with almost no limits to the state of Israel?
You know, this started from the day when President Truman recognized the state of Israel. And in fact, he recognized the state of Israel against the advice of all his major advisors, including the Secretary of State, the Chairman of the Chief of Staff, and all of them. And he said, I'm sorry, gentlemen, I have hundreds of thousands of Jews in among my constituency, and I have to answer to them, because he was running for election and he was behind in public opinion polls. And I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs in my constituency. So from the day one, he took the decision based on personal interest and personal politics, not on American national interest. And unfortunately, things got downward and got worse and worse. If you look at the foreign aid, I wrote my book about 20 years ago. And up till today, it's the only textbook on the subject of American foreign aid and aid to Israel. And I say, and I said that in articles and in interviews, that that doesn't mean that no one can write a book like mine. But the problem is no one can dare, or no one dares to write a book like mine. And this is what happened, that no one was able to write it. The funny thing, that when I was coming on this, my last trip, which is last month, I was sitting and next to somebody, and we start talking, and he is a high official of the USAID. And he tried to explain to me the program of AID and what they do. And his boss was behind us. So I start laughing, and he said, why are you laughing? I told him, I wrote the book. I wrote the textbook on the subject. And he was familiar with my book. And the situation, if you look at how much Israel is getting today, Israel is getting about $3 billion. This is official economic and military aid. And if you, there are many forms of aid that the Israelis are getting that people don't know of. For example, the American government have continued to give them loan guarantees to build houses, and most of the money is being used to build settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. There's a program in the foreign aid called U.S. Hospitals and Schools Abroad, Aisha, U.S. Schools and Hospitals Abroad. All Israeli universities were incorporated in the United States so they can qualify as American schools abroad, and they get money from that one. And there is money that they get also from other things that they have right to buy some equipment that's called old equipment. Then they participate in research and development in the military field. Then there's the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars that they get from the Jewish community through non-profit organizations. For me, I estimated the direct aid to Israel is over $150 billion. And if you add to this the indirect, you are coming close to $250 billion. And if you add to this, because, for example, when they signed the Camp David Agreement back in 1979, at the time of President Carter, Egypt started getting the same amount of aid. Israel was getting at that time about $5 billion. And Egypt started getting $3 billion, now it's less than that. So this aid continues to be given to Egypt in order for Egypt to keep the peace with Israel. So actually it's giving to Israel indirectly to lessen the threat that's coming from Egypt. And America is in the Middle East to protect Israel. We are. In fact, the whole plan, I don't want to go into this, but the whole plan to invade Iraq was actually done by the friends of the Israelis. And they offered the plan to Netanyahu when he was prime minister, and he thought that those people were crazy. So when they came, they found somebody to accept it, which Netanyahu could not accept. So American aid to Israel, and how much we spent to protect Israel, and how much the increase in the price of oil, if you calculate all this, it will be something that you cannot calculate.
And many thanks to us here, the taxpayers that are actually funding the State of Israel. I want to remind the listeners of the phone number to call and ask questions live of our guest, who is Dr. Mohammad Rabia, professor of international political economy, who taught at several Arab and American universities, publisher of numerous books, and who also drafted the original document that guided negotiations and coordinated secret contacts between the U.S. and the PLO. That phone number is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT.
I want to jump in with a couple of questions, if I may, before the funds start to go crazy. One is to follow up on the Iraq issue just for a little while. There's obviously the fighting between the Sunnis and the Shia, and then the Kurds and non-Kurds has its some of its roots in very old Islamic history, but there hadn't been much of it in Iraq for many hundreds of years. And so the question, which I don't think a lot of people have touched on, especially in the Western media, is the extent to which Iraq was held together by Saddam, and he was able to put nationalism above sectarian differences, or the extent to which these sectarian differences are new creations based on a power struggle within this new creation of an Iraqi state, which shares power based on who you vote for and assigns a certain number of seats based on sectarian identity. Where do you think the real root of the issue lies in terms of the sectarian violence in Iraq?
The Shiites in Iraq, there's no doubt that they were, to a great extent, they were oppressed under Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein, mainly the Sunnis, were put in charge of the government for a long time. But that doesn't mean that Sunnis, Shiites, were not part of the government. For example, somebody like Iyad Allawi, who's a Shiite, and he was the former prime minister of Iraq, he is a Shiite, and he was part of the Ba'ath Party. And he was one of those people who worked with Saddam Hussein, then he turned against Saddam Hussein. So the Ba'ath Party tried to put Ba'ath, which is Arab nationalism, on the top of all issues within Iraq, and had a lot of people from the Shiites as well as from the Sunnis. But you can say the closest people around Saddam Hussein were actually even not only from the Sunnis, were from his own old town, from his own tribe. So he was able to put to be able to rule through sheer force. And I always say that Saddam Hussein was, in a way, a democratic person, because he didn't care who makes mistakes. He used to kill everyone. He called his cousin. He killed his two sons-in-law. He killed them. So Saddam Hussein did not kill Shiites only. He killed his own people, his own family. Why? Because he wanted to control Iraq, and that was his objective. And for that objective, to him, means... the objective will justify any means possible to get to where he wanted.
And so is this violence to some extent inevitable as soon as you remove that structure of power, or is it more to do with the imposed sectarian identity of various members of parliament, do you think?
I think really what happened is that the U.S. government, they had wrong information that the Shiites will meet them with the flowers. They thought that since the Shiites did not get their full rights under Saddam Hussein, while nobody got his full rights under Saddam Hussein, but they got less than the Sunnis to a great extent, then they can rely on the Shiites, and the Shiites will be able to control the country with the American people. What really happened, that the Shiites did not only want to control, they wanted to control the other, and they wanted to dominate the rest of the country. And this is why then we got a sectarian government, not really a nationalist government, that could treat all people equally. So we did not bring democracy to Iraq. And unfortunately also, in the last days of Saddam Hussein, or the last years, to be accurate, he brought back tribalism. And he brought tribalism back to be able to control the people, especially when he started the war with the Iranians. Because he was afraid that the Shiites of Iraq will join the Shiites of Iran and fight him in Iraq, which did not happen. But he brought back, after it was a secular state, he brought back some of the tribal issues and elements into the equation within Iraq. Then when that structure collapsed, the biggest mistake that was committed by the U.S. government is to destroy the whole Iraqi state and the Iraqi army and the Iraqi security forces. They thought that they can build a state within months. States take sometimes hundreds of years to be built.
Right.
And you cannot really build something within weeks or months.
You mentioned that they may have had bad information. It seems, based on statements from senior diplomats, U.S. diplomats, that they had no information about 2 weeks before the start of the war. Based on one eyewitness account from a meeting between President Bush and some Iraqi expatriates, including, I suspect, people like Ahmad Chalabi, President Bush didn't even know that there was such a thing as Sunni and Shia in Iraq. He had no idea. He thought they were all Iraqis. And so the amount of lack of knowledge of the country is shocking.
This reminds me of something when President Reagan was president, and when he went he sent American troops to Lebanon. And when they told him that there are Muslims and the Christians and so on, he said, "Oh my God, I thought all Lebanese were Christians and all Palestinians were Muslims." And this, based on that, he was willing to support the Lebanese and to be against the Palestinians. So yeah, people who are ignorant of the facts, they don't know the culture, they do not know the makeup of societies, and they try to assume the decision-making process on behalf of those people without knowledge.
It's a shame. I mean, I wouldn't expect the president to know everything, but I would expect him to at least have advisors who might know enough to understand that there's a difference between various factions.
Or purposely advise him wrong.
Who knows? I mean, it's tragic and it's awful because so many hundreds of thousands of people have been affected by this. A needless war of choice, as you've said, that is illegal. If I could circle back now to the Israeli-Palestinian question just for a moment. You said that Israel has refused all of the peace plans suggested to it and has put preconditions on all of them to some extent or other. The Israeli side, and I suspect to a large extent the American side, which tends to be almost the same thing because of the way the issue is portrayed in the media, will be that it's quite normal to have exceptions or disagreements with plans, and that's how you start negotiations. So if you just give a little bit more detail about some of the things that Israel has objected to and why they claim that it's okay to reject the deals that have been offered to them. Give us a couple of examples.
What they are saying today, the Israelis, which is Olmert said, and he is repeating what other people have said, is that we cannot go to the 1967 borders. That's number one, which means he is interested in taking over land. He wants more land than what Israel had in 1967. And he says we cannot relinquish sovereignty over Jerusalem. So what the plans saying that Jerusalem, the eastern part of Jerusalem, was in the hands of the Arabs in 1967 and the western part was in the hands of the Israelis. So Jerusalem should be the place for the capital of two states. In the eastern part will be the Palestinian state and in the western part will be the Israeli state. Then he says there are no rights for the Palestinians and there is no right of return. So when you reject the right of return and you reject the rights of the Palestinians, then you reject going back to the what you might call internationally recognized borders of 1967, then you and you reject going back to the borders of Jerusalem and giving the Arabs the part that they had before 1967, then what's left actually to negotiate? The Israelis expanded the area of Jerusalem to include almost 40% of this tank. So when you say that they can take Jerusalem, you're saying they should take or they can take 40% of the West Bank. So what's left to negotiate? So this is how they are really playing with the whole thing. Say, okay, we'll negotiate, but exclude this, this, and this. When you exclude all these, nothing really is left to negotiate.
We want to remind the listeners of the phone number to call. We have 8 minutes left, so if you have any questions, please go ahead and give us a call now.
We have probably less than that, because I know we need to play some announcements at the end.
713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. Dr. Abia, let me ask you about the lobby, the Zionist lobby here in the United States, or AIPAC, and its impact on the U.S. foreign policy, whether towards Palestine, towards Iraq, or the Middle East in general. How significant is that?
It's very, very significant. And you mentioned Paul Findlay and his book, They Dare to Speak Out. No one seems in Congress willing to challenge the Israeli lobby, and all of them are going along with whatever the Israeli lobby demands and wants. And there has no precedent to the influence that the Israeli lobby has on the U.S. government.
All right. I think we are getting phone calls now, so we want to give the opportunity to our listeners to ask questions live. Again, the number is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT.
And our first caller tonight is Patty. Patty, go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just really curious. You were talking about the ignorance as to the Sunni and Shiites in Iraq. Now, I'm not the smartest person as far as Middle East politics, but it seems like everybody knows that there's different tribes in all of the Arabian countries. How could the Bush administration be that ignorant of factions and tribes and tribe politics?
Well, I think you really have to ask them this question, but I can tell you from my own experience, I met with American politicians who are very, very knowledgeable, and they have very good information, and I've seen others who really don't have any. And I have seen a very high former official of the U.S. Navy. He was actually the chairman of the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown when I was teaching there. And he was as ignorant and as anything could be. And I also met with some people like William Quant and Dr. Hudson, who are extremely knowledgeable and know. But unfortunately, just like in the Arab countries, I say in the Arab countries who know what should be done to change the situation have no power. And people who are in power don't know what to do. And this is the situation in America today.
And just a little bit more detail, I was doing some looking up online. One of the people who's mentioned this story is Peter Galbraith. He's a former U.S. diplomat. He said that he was at the White House Super Bowl party in January of 2003 with President Bush and three members of the Iraqi opposition when they were talking about this Sunni-Shia issue, and the president at that point showed some surprise and didn't know that there was such a thing. So that's a little bit more information. You can Google that if you like. Peter Galbraith. And
nothing surprises us from President Bush anymore, actually. I wanted to mention the website before we go to the next caller. A website for our guest, who is Dr. Muhammad Rabia, where he has most of his articles published there and a list of all his books and so on. Tell us about that website, Dr. Rabia.
I actually worked very hard on it and with professional people. It has 17 of my books, 7 in English and 10 in Arabic. It has a few articles, scholarly papers, and a few articles in English. It has also some poetry in English as well as in Arabic, and my weekly article. So it's called yazur.com. Yazur, it's Y-A-Z-O-U-R, yazur.com. And you can go to it, and I give the right to visitors to view, to read, and download anything they would like to have from that website. It also has a gallery of pictures and a few other things.
And we will have a link to that on our website, arabvoices.net. Let's see if we can take one more call.
Hopefully we'll have time to squeeze it in. Bobby, are you there?
Bobby, go ahead.
My question is,
if you could turn your radio off, please, then there'll be no delay and we'll be able to hear you clearly.
Question is, okay. The American people, knowing that Bush had a personal vengeance and that he was willing to lie, why is the truth so hard to come about why the war is really happening?
Okay, Bobby, thank you. Doctor, any thoughts on how the American people were deceived so easily at the start of this war?
It's unfortunately the people, what's called the new cons, who had put the plan for Netanyahu back about 7-8 years ago, and he would not buy it, came to President Bush because they were able to come back to the government in the Pentagon and in the National Security Council, and they were able to convince President Bush. What they really wanted to do is how to make America as an empire to dominate the whole world. And they wanted to look for something that's easy. And everyone knew that going into Iraq is going to be easy. But getting out of Iraq, nobody thought about it. And they thought if they can occupy Iraq, then everyone will be intimidated, including North Korea as well as Iran, and even the Europeans and the Chinese, and everyone will just go along. Unfortunately, they went into Iraq, they destroyed the state, and we can say they failed. And this is how it all happened. You look for something easy to give you much credibility and much standing, and when you fail, the failure is just monumental.
And we are out of time. We wish we had more time to spend with Dr. Mohammad Rabia, professor of international political economy and publisher of numerous books and articles. Thank you, Dr. Mohammad, so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate having me.
And many thanks for listening to Arab Voices and for all of those who called in to participate. And many thanks to my co-host, Mark. That wraps it up for the show tonight. This is Saeed, producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next Wednesday, peace on earth.